everybody, and welcome to the show. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore. Grab yourselves a glass of scotch, pull your seat up to the fire, and let's learn some cool shit tonight. On today's program, I have author and cryptozoologist Denver Michaels, and we're going to be talking water monsters south of the border, a little bit of lost civilizations, paranormal, the unexplained, and anything that he has on his mind. A very, very interesting gentleman. I just read his latest book that was out in September, Water Monsters South of the Border. A fantastic read. Check it out on Amazon or on iBooks, on the iTunes App Store. Fantastic, fantastic value for the knowledge that is contained. Again, Denver has absolutely impressed me with his just adventures in terms of learning all about the water monsters south of the border. And also check out denvermichaels.net, because his blog is just a chock full of everything that you could look for as far as dealing with Sasquatch, UFOs, you name it. I've been having a blast with it the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to bring him on the program. But first, I wanted to thank everybody who has been tuning into the show and supporting us. Subscribe to the channel when you do get a chance. And if you have any questions or you want me to read your correspondence on the air, hit me up with an email at info@denoflore.com, and we will read it out for you before the next show. So let us see how Mr. Michaels is doing. Denver, are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm here.
Fantastic. Just kill the intro music. Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me tonight. Again, I understand that you've got a very busy schedule, but still, your work has impressed me to no end, and I just had to have you on here. So thank you very much. First of all, again, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. What's been keeping you busy since the book has come out?
Just researching for other things. Been doing some remodeling around the house. Everything, life, pretty much.
Well, you know what? As I said before, it's I know you're a busy guy, and considering people like us, we do a lot of research ourselves, and exactly how much that can. How much time that can actually take up. So I get it completely. Again, I have to ask, everyone's got a different story, and I always ask everyone who comes onto the program, how did you get into the field of cryptozoology? Like, what kind of started things off for you?
I've always, been into just weird things. I've always been into the paranormal, cryptozoology, that sort of thing. I really kind of got into the lake monster bit, and I'm dating myself here, but in the late 80s, early 90s, the Unsolved Mysteries show, they did a little bit on the Ogopogo up there in Canada, and kind of opened my eyes that there's more to lake monsters than just the Loch Ness monster. So I kind of got interested in that from there. And yeah, I've just always had an interest in the more offbeat things.
You know, I actually remember that episode, believe it or not. I kind of date myself as well, well into my 30s at this point. Even with that, I know with that, that's out in Ogopogo was out in Lake Okanagan near Kelowna, British Columbia. That's several 1,000 kilometers in the west direction.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
That's out west by about several 1,000 kilometers, and I was actually just checking out the Unsolved Mysteries website before it blasted my headphones with some music. But it's out in Kelowna, BC. It's been around since 1937, and it pretty well, it's kind of like the Canadian equivalent to the Loch Ness Monster, for anybody who's listening. Now, What about your work with the paranormal and UFOs? Like, how did you get into that? Is it kind of one with the other, or was there a separate experience?
No, it just kind of all blends together. I've just kind of been interested in all of it, and always. Learned as much as I could about it, researched as much as I could, and then finally a couple years ago, I always had the desire to write a book, and that's when I just decided, hey, why don't we put some of this interest I have into writing, and it just kind of really took off from there,
Now, are you a trained author, or was this something that you just kind of threw into how did you start writing as an author?
I just started. I'm not trained or anything. I just kind of picked it up.
Now, with your first book, and unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity the last little while to be able to read the first book, but again. If it's any good as your second book, it's something that I'm going to have to be able to read over the next week. The first book is, and for anyone else listening, it's People Are Seeing Something, A Survey of Lake Monsters in the United States and Canada. For both books, by the way, you can find the links directly to the Amazon sites for both. So if you want to pick it up on Kindle or by paperback, please go right ahead. But I know I realize that the United States and Canadian book was your first one. What was the story behind that one in particular?
Like I was saying, I've always had an interest in this kind of thing, and when I decided to write a book, I was kind of wrestling back and forth. Should I write about this? Should I write about that? And I just kind of have just really always been so interested in lake monsters for whatever reason, and it was just a good fit for me to write my first book. So that's really how it started.
And what in particular? Because I know that a lot of it's there's a lot of hoaxes that are out there as far as whether it's lake monsters, whether it's Sasquatch, guys in suits, as it were. I think one of the big things for, let's say, for Nessie out at Loch Ness was somebody just tying some tires together and having it float out there. What are some like the stuff that you ran into as far as like here in North America where people were just trying to pull the wool over your eyes?
Well, you definitely have a lot of that, and you have a lot of reports, especially around the late 1800s, early 1900s, of really newspapers, having real sensationalist articles and things where they actually pull pranks on their readers and things like that. But so you get a lot of that, and as you're researching it, and of course you have, just outright stories and things. And in the present day, there's one in particular that I can think of, the Oklahoma octopus, researching that, it just sounded so cool, a freshwater octopus in Oklahoma, right? But, and I so badly wanted it to be true, but, the more I researched it, everything kept coming back to, a Lost Tapes episode on Animal Planet. It was almost like someone watched that and then put something on the internet, and it just kind of spread from there. So you really have to be careful to separate the wheat from the chaff, and it can be frustrating at times separating hoaxes from actual sightings and things. But I think there's enough honest people out there that have seen some unusual things to warrant the belief that there might be something in the waters that we haven't discovered yet.
Well, even with something like along the lines of like a giant octopus. Again, I'm this is not the first time I've heard of it particularly, but if I'm not even sure if octopuses or octopi, I should say, even grow that large. Again, I know of octopi that have, or at least have heard of, ones that have escaped from their enclosures. I know one, or I've heard of some that have, you know, been able to open up their enclosures enough to be able to shoot something out at the light to be able to short it out. But so, do you think something like that could potentially exist, given how intelligent they can be?
Yeah, I don't rule it out. I mean, there are reports of, like you said, octopi escaping and actually heading up into rivers and being in fresh water for a time. So, you know, I suppose it's possible that things like that could happen or maybe even have happened. But at the same time, you know, you get a lot of these reports, and like in the Oklahoma octopus thing, those are in man-made lakes, so it makes it a little harder for something like that to be true. But you know, I'm not quick to rule things out, though.
What was probably one of the funnest of the North American water monsters that you were trying to look into? Like, what was kind of your white whale? You know, excuse the pun.
The one really that I had the most fun writing about was the White River Monster in Arkansas, and also I guess parts of Missouri too. It's supposedly been seen, but you know, there's really a long history with that creature, and it kind of started back in the, well, I say the 30s was when it really, really kind of took off, but there were you know, some earlier reports, and then it kind of went quiet, and then again in the 70s, there was like another round of sightings, and actually the Arkansas legislature created a White River Monster refuge, where it's illegal to you know, molest or disturb the monster or whatever. But that was really cool to write about, and you know, the conclusion I came up with, and you know, based on, you know, what other people have said and the descriptions of it, was it was probably some sort, and I don't know how it would have gotten there, but like some sort of a wayward elephant seal, because it matches the descriptions of that perfectly. So it was really a fun story, and there's a lot, even if people want to check it out and they don't read my book necessarily, there's a lot on the internet that you can read about the White River Monster, and it's really a cool story.
Now, the big one that I've heard about is that it was said to have been responsible for overturning a Confederate munitions boat during the Civil War. So that's like that's kind of one of the biggest things that shocks me about these types of monsters, is that, you know, the sightings sometimes go back 200-300 years. And one of the prevailing theories for these types of things is that they're kind of dinosaur related, or they're essentially dinosaurs that have lived on past, you know, past the Pleistocene, etc., into the modern age, which could make them potentially thousands of years old. Now, we as humans have never really dealt with anything that's effectively immortal, so, you know, how were you able to first kind of wrap your mind around the idea that these things could potentially be, you know, generations and generations and generations older than we are?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on its face, it does sound kind of crazy, but, you know, we have animals, you know, look at crocodiles or alligators, you know, those kind of animals, you know, that they've been around forever, you know, so, you know, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that, you know, perhaps a, like just a small remnant population has somehow survived into the present day. you know, perhaps these, what you find is these glacial lakes in, you know, Canada, the northern United States is really where you find the bulk of these lake monster reports. And it just kind of makes me wonder if, you know, perhaps, you know, maybe some sort of large reptiles from ages ago got, you know, became landlocked in these lakes some way. You know, I don't know. I'm just kind of guessing, but it seems possible to me.
Also, going back to the point, or at least there's the theorized Lake Missoula, which was on top of the glacial. On top of the North American glaciers back during the last ice age. So, you know, something like that could potentially be possible. Again, none of us were alive back then. I sure as heck know, you know, I don't remember much past 1985, so I can't even say for myself. When you're dealing with Canada, like, Canada's a very large country. United States is a very large country. So, considering the number of potential, whether we're real or not, what would you say would be the most crazy situation that you would run into as far as dealing with North American lake monsters? Like, what kind of just made you go, as it were?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. There's just so many reports and, so many different creatures and, yeah, there's one that's kind of cool. Also, is another wayward seal from Lake Simcoe, and you know, is theorized that you know, that it came down, I guess, through the St. Lawrence River and kind of kept hopping into different lakes, and ended up being spotted as a monster. And at the same time, there's also reports of a serpent-like creature in that lake as well. So it's, you know, a lot of these legends get kind of intermingled, and it's kind of hard to you know, to really know what's going on in a lot of these cases.
Now, moving south of the border, and again, this is one the subject that I had read up on extensively. How did you launch off from doing the North American water monsters to actually, you know, trekking out south of the border, especially considering everything that is going on there as far as, you know, drug violence and just, you know, traveling by yourself out there? I know it's not the same everywhere, and it is isolated in certain areas, but how did you just kind of decide to go about doing that, especially with how dangerous it could potentially be?
Well, the only country I was able to really visit was Peru. Mexico, I wasn't able to go there, and there's a lot of other countries that I want to visit, but I was able to visit Peru. But what I wanted to the reason I wanted to do this book was the North American lake monsters. You find a lot of the same kind of thing in Scandinavia, Russia, and those places. So I was just curious, what kind of creatures are that? Do you have the same kind of creatures down that way? And it seems like the only place in South America that you really do is like in the Patagonia region, where there's you know, where there's glacial lakes left over. Most of the water monsters in Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, you're dealing with a lot of more like massive snakes and like a lot of creatures that might be mythical, that sort of thing.
Now, jumping into Patagonia, I know with Patagonia there's a lot of mythos, whether it's through dealing with cryptids or dealing with lost civilizations, especially how Patagonia actually got its name. What are some examples from Patagonia that you found were some of the most, as far as, I'm going to say the most intriguing or the most kind of out of this world?
Well, like you said, just the way that Patagonia got its name, it was the land of the giants. So, a lot of that gets kind of swept up under the rug these days. But, the European explorers, when they landed there, specifically talked about giants. And we're not just talking about just tall people. I mean, we're talking about people, 10 foot tall. And the same thing, Easter Island, it was described. So I think those legends are interesting. But, as far as the water monsters go, the natives have just so many cool legends that you just kind of wonder, if it's not exactly as they describe it, then how did this legend come about? There's one called the, and I'm probably going to butcher all of the names, but the Lacuma, I think is how you would say it. It's supposed to be like a giant hand-like creature that, just kind of will like bust out of the icy water, grab you and drown you. So it's, there's something behind that legend. How it came to be is hard to say.
What about the Patagonian plesiosaur? And I'm probably going to butcher the names myself. From what I understand, that came to prominence like really in the early 1920s. Now, believe it or not, from what I can recall from your book, you actually said it was done by a Canadian, or actually had been discovered by a Canadian.
I can't remember all these witnesses, their names start to run together, but a Canadian and his son, I believe, were boating on the lake there, and there's no way I can say the name the name of the lake. So anyway, they saw something, and it matched the like a Loch Ness monster report almost, or what have you, and he reported it, I think, to the Toronto Globe, I want to say, and they ran a story. I think they ran the story in the 20s, but I think his sighting was about 10 years prior to that. And then in the 20s, you had a lot of American and European, Canadian prospectors down in the area, and they were having reports, and eventually an expedition was put together, but no hard evidence came from it, but there have been a lot of reports in some of those Patagonian lakes of plesiosaur-like creatures or what have you.
Now, going north of that, and we're probably going to go like right to the opposite end of the continent, the one thing that's been getting me and what really got me excited about your book is the giant anacondas of the Amazon, which,
yes.
I know that's a big chunk of the book. Having grown up with seeing that movie and, thinking to myself, well, that can't necessarily be real. And then reading some of the reports and considering Brazil is one of the largest countries as far as landmass in the world. It's, I'm going to say, about potentially 2/3 the size of the continental United States. And a lot of it's been completely unexplored. So when I'm reading something about giant snakes that are awaking from a giant slumber and coming out of the ground towards somebody, or wrecking entire villages, it seems a little bit crazy, but at the same time it's like, I think that's a possibility. I've seen photos on the web, and I know that when it comes to Photoshop, being a guy who is a graphic designer, a lot of it can be faked, but you yourself traveled the Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. So like how did you get, well, first of all, how did you travel out there? And what were your experiences as far as researching some of the monsters in your travels?
Well, I stayed in an eco lodge, in the Amazon, and it's about a 4.5 hour boat ride from the nearest small town. And you know, when I was there, I was very curious about the giant anaconda. The I kind of referred to it as the Yaku Mama. That's one of the common names. And I asked my guide, about the Yaku Mama. And this is the thing, you know, you hear a lot of these reports and stuff, and, you know, people scoff at them and things like that. But in the late 90s, there was a rash of, like you were just talking about, of villages being destroyed and things. And so I was asking my guide, and I was, you know, I kind of approached the subject kind of, you know, just kind of cautiously. I thought he's going to kind of laugh at me or whatever. You know, it's just generally what people do with with these sort of topics. But yeah, I was talking to him about anacondas, and he's like, yeah, I took a picture of one last year, and yeah, he told me how long it was, and I want to say it was about, you know, 29 feet long. He told me how many meters it was. Anyway, I think it ended up, you know, when I did the calculation, being about 29 feet. And that is, I mean, that's almost a giant anaconda in its own right. I mean, that's huge. And we got to talking more, you know, and I'm like, well, what about the Yaku Mama? I'm like, is that real? And, you know, again, I thought he was going to kind of laugh at me. And he's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, it's real. He's like, I haven't seen it, you know, but my grandmother did. He told me, told me the story about when one, and apparently these things, they burrow underground and hibernate for long periods of time, and then when they wake up, coming out of the ground, they head to a water source, a river or what have you. And it causes almost seismic activity, and it uproots trees and cuts trenches through the ground and all of that. And anyway, he was telling me about what his grandmother had told him, and then the next day, you know, he talked about it some more. And I just thought it was so cool to talk to someone that's actually, of course, his secondhand knowledge on his part, you know, but to talk to someone who's got some experience with that. And when you're there in that jungle, I mean, I just believe literally anything could be there. It's just so vast and like you're saying, so much of it's unexplored. There could be anything in that water and in under that canopy.
Well, the amount of explorers that have just gone out there and said, okay, well, I'm going to go check some stuff out in the Amazon, and have not come back. there are so many that I've read about, I actually cannot come up with any names at the moment, because there are so many. Even for ourselves, they're not now just starting to find a lot of the ancient pyramids that are underneath the canopies that have been, you know, that there may have been civilizations there at some point, but now that there hasn't been anybody living there for potentially tens of thousands of years, you know, all of the jungle has just reclaimed everything, which I find just absolutely wild. I know that there were some there were some legends of, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people who lived in the Amazon that were contacted at some point, like way back when the conquistadors finally started coming to South America. You know, who knows what's there. I found the interesting part that the migratory patterns of the snakes, the giant anacondas, were kind of mapped out, how they would go towards the tributaries of two rivers joining, which I just found absolutely insane. Like, how do you get to know this type of information if nobody's ever seen one?
Well, it seems like, well, I mean, a researcher, Mike Warner from Northern Ireland, he's probably the most knowledgeable about the Yakumama, giant anaconda, whatever you want to call it. And that was one of the theories that he had, is they like to go to the confluence of two rivers. And it makes sense because there's more food source there. I know, you know, like if anybody that does any fishing for catfish or whatever, large catfish, the confluence of two rivers or two streams is always just a really good spot. And but anyway, what Mike Warner had found was looking at Google Earth images, he read the accounts of Percy Fawcett, who was an explorer, you know, like you were talking about in the early 1900s. And Fawcett wrote of these giant anacondas, and in his writings, he described killing a anaconda 62 feet long. Now, a lot of people have kind of poo-pooed that and whatever, but that his writings are, you know, not really called into question too much, you know, except for that, because it just sounds so unbelievable. But at any rate, Fawcett would mention these channels through the jungle that lead like from rivers and just kind of terminate abruptly in the jungle. And so Warner, studying imagery, you know, kind of figured out their patterns that way, and he led his own expedition down there, and his site is www.bigsnakes.info, and he's got a lot of pretty compelling evidence that he might have actually gotten some photographs that could be something.
Now, as far as Fawcett's concerned, didn't he also at least report on the enigmatic Amazon region of the Mono Grande, the large monkey?
He reported on a lot of unusual things, including a dog with two noses, which is kind of neat.
Now, for the large monkey, have you looked into that, or did you just stick with the water monsters themselves?
You know, I just stuck with the water creatures for now. There's there's a lot of other creatures that I want to get into in the future, but for now, I just kind of had to pick and choose.
Now, what were some of the regular reports that you were reading besides, let's say entire villages getting destroyed? Like, what was kind of more the common, theme with each one of these reports?
Well, the common theme was like we were talking that, like seismic act, and you know, a lot of this is blamed on seismic activity or torrential rain or whatever, but you would have almost like an earthquake or whatever, and trees just being uprooted, and as a giant snake goes into the water. And in one of the reports, and this one report that I'm thinking of, I can't remember which village it is off the top of my head, but this was actually reported by Reuters in the late 90s, and it was just there were a few witnesses that saw the snake, and it was described as being two school buses or whatever long, and dark in color, and there were some fishermen out in the river that saw it flip, some boats were flipped over as it went to the water. So you have that, and then there's also been reports. There's one report where a lady's home was destroyed by one of these things. They lived real close, had a house on stilts, and one of these snakes pushed a giant debris pile into her home and just leveled it. And she believed that the snake wanted to get rid of them. And I know that sounds crazy, but if you think about it, as people push further into the wilderness and more in contact with these creatures, you're going to have more encounters like that. So it makes sense on some level.
Now, even in Mexico, I without butchering the name, I'm going to say giant anacondas. Continuously. They're even found in Mexico. Is this not correct? But maybe under different names.
Well, I'm not sure if they're found in Mexico or not. I was kind of theorizing that perhaps they were, because a lot of like sea serpent, lake monster type reports, that the size matches up quite well. And in Nicaragua, there's one, I don't know how to say the name, the SERP or something like that. Anyway, we'll just call it giant anaconda. But anyway, it's a large burrowing creature that matches reports of the Minicao in Brazil. And it's said to be, 100, 150 feet long, burrows underground. And when it, when it comes out, just destroys things. There's a lot of reports from Nicaragua in the late 1800s, and I came across one from, I think from the early 40s. I can't remember off the top of my head where that was reported at. But anyway, in the book, I took some pieces from a couple articles where there were comparisons made to the Minicao, which I believe is the same thing, the giant anaconda or whatever in Brazil, the same thing showing up in Nicaragua. So I kind of theorized that maybe some of these reports in Mexico, maybe you're dealing with a giant anaconda there. I don't know.
Yeah, considering Mesoamerican literature and religion dealing with Quetzalcoatl, and again, I'm going to be jumping between Mexico and Peru here for a little bit, but for the imagery dealing with Quetzalcoatl, especially in Mayan, imagery. Especially since if you've been to Mexico, and again, I haven't. I have friends who've gone to visit the pyramids down there. How do you kind of figure that is? How those reports kind of coincide with their own religion for that, from that past.
Well, a lot of the legends they're kind of murky these days, but Quetzalcoatl and which was and in Guatemala, Kukulcan, Cucumatz, depending on where you're at, but all kind of the Yeah, the same thing is described as a just a massive plumed serpent. I mean, in the legends too, Quetzalcoatl is a man or a god, a deity, what have you. But I just kind of I kind of theorized with the reports I was talking about with what you have in Nicaragua and South America, maybe the serpent, might be based on something that the natives had knowledge of. Maybe the giant anaconda, Yaku Mama, whatever you want to call it. And I just kind of made that leap that maybe the plumed serpent with Quetzalcoatl was some way related.
And how would this relate to the, and again, I may butcher this, the Acambaro figures that depict the thousands of figurines that were found in the 1940s that potentially depict dinosaurs?
Well, yeah, in Acambaro, Mexico, just tons. I want to say over 3,000 figurines were discovered. I want to say in the 1940s by a German immigrant, and these figurines were they're all sorts of I mean exact replicas of dinosaurs, just hundreds of dinosaur-like figurines. And I forget the tribe that or the period that they belong to, but anyway, I know that they are thousands of years old. And of course, archaeologists came to investigate and were pretty quick to dismiss them. But Charles Hapgood and others have investigated them and actually conducted their own excavations in some other spots where that they excavated a spot under a local sheriff's home and found some others. So they know that those couldn't have been planted or whatever. And it just seems that there may be just some remnant dinosaurs that might have lived a lot longer than we thought. I mean, of course, these discoveries have been discredited, and a lot of people think you're a kook for bringing it up. But the point is, even if they aren't legitimate, I can't be sure that they're really getting a fair hearing. You know what I'm saying? Because they're just so the ramifications are just so huge that I'm not sure if people don't just dismiss them just because of what if it is true? I mean, there's just a lot that we don't know that we thought we knew.
Especially if you're dealing with ancient civilizations and just lost knowledge. Again, I'm not sure if you've heard of Klaus Dohna before, and that's actually where I first heard of the Acambaro figures. And just the sheer amount of artifacts and just links between, let's say, Egypt or in South America, it's just insane. How people can kind of stick their head in the sand and decide what is, the absolute truth when, Einstein said, like, and again, I'm paraphrasing here, when we as a human species don't know shit about shit. So, to me, like, to be able to discredit something out of hand unless you've looked through every single corner just kind of seems very disingenuous and just kind of callous. It's like, are you doing your job or are you just kind of lazy? Like, where that's kind of my attitude towards that type of that type of science where it's like, oh, this is not possible. It's like, well, fuck, why not?
Yeah, that's how I feel about it too, because it's like, well, we know that that this species was alive now, or we know that this culture was around here, but there's just so much evidence that there was pre-Columbian contact in the Americas. I mean, like you were saying, the Egyptians, there's even like in those Akambaro figurines, there's Sumerian motifs, African motifs, so it just seems so. If you really look at a lot of the evidence that's out there, it just seems so obvious that peoples were communicating with one another and trading with one another and influencing one another way, way, way before we give credit for.
Like, one of the craziest reports that I've heard of personally is that, and again, I'm probably going to get some angry emails about this from some government officials, but fuck it, I don't care. apparently at some point in the early 2000s, the Brazilian government actually found a wreck of a ancient Roman ship in shallow waters. And because of the amount of BS that it would have caused, they covered the entire thing up and basically just destroyed the wreck. So, you know, even then you have Egyptian mummies that have been found to have cocaine within their systems. And again, people have tried to disprove it and say, no, it must have been some type of contamination. But the tests again and again have said, no, they actually did have this in their system. Even to the point where the, what was it, the very, very similar hieroglyphics within the Mayan culture and their alphabet and their hieroglyphics to the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics being very similar. It's like, how do you not see this? It's like, you know, lay people can kind of figure this stuff out, but you've got the people who've got the PhDs who just completely discount it out of hand.
Right.
Which,
right,
again, drives me insane. It's one of the reasons why I've got this show, to be able to call this stuff out and to be able to talk to people who kind of get it, as it were. But beyond that, like, what are your experiences as far as, like, looking into ancient cultures? Because that's something I've been looking into for the better part of a decade. And I'm always interested to talk to another guy who has the same kind of passion as I do.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's one of that's been one of my hobbies for as long as I can remember, studying these things like you're talking in Brazil, when Percy Fawcett, he's wrote in his books about the blonde-eyed blonde-haired, blue-eyed Indians there, and the lost cities there. I mean, there's explorers like him. Him and his son and a party went off searching for the he called it the lost city of Z, and he wasn't, in my mind, you read his writings, he wasn't searching to get rich. You know, he wasn't a greedy conquistador. He wanted to solve a mystery, and him and his son and their his son's friend that went with him, they were never seen again, and parties went out looking for him and never found him. And he gave his life trying to solve mysteries. And I just wish there were more people like that were, willing to lay it out there to solve a mystery, because there's so much that we don't know. And like we were talking about the Patagonian giants and things, and not many people know that's what it means, land of giants. And it was called that, not because these natives were a little bit taller. They were a lot taller. They were 10 feet tall. And you get the same thing in Easter Island and Native Americans in the, you know, in the Southwest, they've got the legends of the red-haired giants that, you know, they were finally able to stamp out. And there's, there, you know, there's just so many things like this that, that I wish that more people knew about. And, and that, you know, people, you know, not guys like me, people that actually have PhDs were out there studying and looking into, you know, it shouldn't be some clown like me talking about it. It, you know, it should be somebody with some credentials out there looking into this stuff.
Well, you know, even with most of those PhDs, that the idea of, you know, let's say Egyptology, it's kind of been around for only about 150, 200 years almost. So at some point, some guys created their own credentials about this stuff, which was based off of somebody else's work who, and that guy didn't have any credentials. He, you know, his work basically made the credentials. So why are we listening to people who have a quote unquote scientific method when their entire scientific method is to completely disavow stuff? Well, we should just be kind of searching after knowledge. That's, you know, like that. That's kind of the whole point. Humanity, we live to know and figure shit out. That's the purpose of why we're kind of here, whether it's why we're actually here or where we've been. You know, like even with, you know, you talked about giants and, you know, I used to have like a study group, quote unquote, way back when. But like 5 years ago, where we basically got together as a group and talked about all this stuff. And, you know, the idea of the giants that, you know, lived in, well, there's many reports of giants in North America. There's many reports of giants in, you know, anywhere from England, Scotland, mainland Europe, from the Middle East. And, you know, even going back to the Bible in Genesis, where the Great Flood was specifically made to kind of wipe out the giants because the giants were apparently a giant boo-boo as far as the creators' fault were, as far as the creators were concerned. And, you know, there's a lot of disparity between the, you know, there's a lot of disparity between what's currently out there as far as physical evidence and what's actually been found. A lot of it's just hearsay and conjecture. Now, with what you found, like what kind of like giant stories did you run into in your travels while writing these two books, if any?
Well, of course, the you know, the giants, you know, in Patagonia mainly, but most of my study of giants has been out in the Ohio Valley, out West Virginia, Ohio, the burial mounds out there. There's just so many reports from the 1800s, even up like into the 1930s, where giant skeletons were found and, you know, actually published in newspapers and stuff, and the Smithsonian, you know, took a lot of these skeletons, and of course now they say they don't have them. They don't have any record of them or anything. So, you know, it just seems like a lot of things like that have, just been swept under the rug, and it's just a shame.
Well, from what I can recall from it, like a 2014, or actually, this came out back in 2016. It's from Snopes.com. And apparently, from what I can understand, there's a possibility, and one of the claims is that the Smithsonian actually admitted to destroying about, you know, thousands of giant skeletons in the early 1900s. And a lot of it came down to the person who was running it at the time was essentially, you know, a giant kind of asshole, as it were. And his whole thing was, okay, this is our narrative and we're sticking to it. But, you know, we still have mounds that are out there, and I know that they're protected sites, but like it hasn't, like, some archaeologist or somebody who said, well, shit, I'm going to find this stuff out, you know, to be able to get some permission to kind of dig up these mounds or do some type of radar, you know, like some radar research and radar imaging of what's actually under these things. Like, how has nobody done this at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that there should, should be a lot of that, but in a lot of cases, the mounds are protected. There's tribes that lay claim to them and don't want them disturbed. And in other cases, I visited a mound out in West Virginia a few weeks ago, and it was a pretty small mound. So, and it was close to the town of Clarksburg. So, if that mound were out in the woods or something, you would never know it's there, with the growth and everything over it. It would just look like just a natural formation over time. So that might have a lot to do with it too. Who knows how many undiscovered, mounds are out there.
What about the Lovelock? This is probably the most famous, the most famous giant story, which would be those of Lovelock Cave. And I know it's been overdone to the point of nauseam. What are your thoughts on, like, I know, have you read into this? Like, have you read into to Lovelock Cave?
Yeah, I have. I'm not that knowledgeable about it, but yeah, I'm familiar with the stories.
Now, like, one of the biggest things, I'm sorry, were you?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
One of the biggest things that always jumps at me with these things is the red hair with the giant skeletons. What do you think is a possibility as far as giants being kind of the an offshoot or being even related to people who have red hair now?
Yeah, I'm not sure. If you look in the Bible where it talks about giants, I want to say there's about six or close to six different groups of the giants described. So I don't know if the red hair, like just one of those or when you hear about the giants that the European explorers came across in Easter Island, they're not described as being redheaded. I don't remember. I think they were lighter skinned than the natives, but I don't recall if they were redheaded or not. But I don't know. Maybe there were just several different races of the giants, because the Bible specifically mentions several different groups: the Anakim, I'm butchering names, Rephaim, and there are a whole bunch of other ones.
Now, getting off the giant issue, and going more like sticking still with the ancient history, with your travels around, Central and South America, how going into dealing with, let's say, Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha, what are your thoughts on those two stories being related? Because even though I know that the Quetzalcoatl was considered, a giant serpent, the stories are eerily similar, and or just they're kind of too close to be not related, at least in my opinion. What have you looked into in that?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, Viracocha, the Andean god, is an archetype. I mean, Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, Kukulcan, Cucumatz, and even Bochica in Colombia. They all are just so similar, and they all seem to appear after some sort of great catastrophe, and they're all benevolent. They're like for instance, Quetzalcoatl. I mean, we know in the Mayan and the Aztec culture, the level of human sacrifice there was just unprecedented. It was just so ingrained. And in Quetzalcoatl, was he was against that sort of thing. He wanted sacrifices of flowers and they say flowers and butterflies, that sort of thing. He put an end to that, and he was benevolent. And all of these deities, they were great teachers. They they taught the people how to have a civil society. They were builders, and so it just seems that it's too similar not to have some kind of relation, because they all show up in a time of great darkness, and it's my belief that maybe at the end of the last ice age, the world was certainly a turbulent, terrible place back then, with all the the catastrophic changes that were going on, and that's probably where the story of the biblical flood and all of the flood legends all over the world come from. It's probably from the end of the last ice age, and so I don't know. What these deities were, if they were, I don't know, maybe remnant people from a more advanced civilization that kind of spread out through, throughout the world to, try to rebuild civilization or what the deal was. But they're all so similar, it can't be ignored.
Now, going back to the last Ice Age, What are your thoughts on Egypt? As far, again, not knowing how far you've read into pre-dynastic Egypt, from anything dealing with Egypt pre, let's say, 3000, 4000 BC, there's no history, no nothing. Yet at the same time, there seems to be some type of connection again with the South American continent. And one of the prevailing theories is, or not to say one of the prevailing theories, a theory is that Atlantis, or at least the original land for Egypt, actually came from South America. And if depending on how the continent is situated, that it's potential that the land was actually situated somewhere around the mouth of the Amazon. So is this there? Like, are these types of stories or theories that you've run into in your travels out there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with it, with a lot of those stories. And, it certainly seems possible. And as far as Egypt goes, I kind of subscribe to more of the theory that the structures there, the pyramids, the Sphinx, that they're actually much, 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 much older than what they say that they actually are, and along with a lot of the other megalithic structures throughout the world.
Now, having traveled in the Amazon yourself, from what I can recall, going to the Amazon was actually kind of one of your biggest dreams, wasn't it? And how did you feel when you actually entered the rainforest for the first time?
Well, it's really just it was a dream of mine, and definitely a bucket list thing, and to be able to do that I was very blessed. And when you enter the rain, and especially at night in the rainforest, and you turn your flashlight off or whatever, and you look up and you can't even see anything, no stars or anything, because the canopy is just so dense. It's just, I really don't have words for it. It's just awesome. And, I recommend, anyone that's, that's a thing that they want to do. I mean, just if you can make it happen, I do it, because it's one of those things that you'll definitely come away from it richer in your life experience.
Now, also having to travel to like places like Cusco, I haven't actually been to Cusco myself. It's kind of, that's probably one of my bucket lists, is to be able to actually see the architecture out there. Like, did you actually see some of the older architecture around the temples that people have claimed that are thousands and thousands and thousands of years old?
Yeah, sure, and I visited the Cori Concha in Cusco, and outside of Cusco, Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, but a lot of those real famous places, there for as many of those real famous places, there's just megalithic ruins all over the place, places you've never heard of. And even walking the streets of Cusco, I mean, there's towering cathedrals and all of that everywhere, but there's buildings that are set right on top of these ancient megalithic blocks and things. It's really just incredible, the stonework and stuff that you see there.
Now, as far as the stonework's concerned, knowing that you're not, you have been doing some remodeling on your house, so I don't know how much into masonry you actually are, but what is your take on how the stones were actually shaped? Do you think that they were, just kind of poured as concrete? Do you think that they were like superheated and then molded, or just cut? Like, you've seen them firsthand. I haven't. So, like, well, what's your opinion on that?
Well, I don't know. I know that's a cop out. I really just don't know. But like at Sacsayhuaman, the one thing that impressed me, of course, the size of them. I don't even know how they got them there, but just supposing they did get them there and cut them or what have you, what impressed me, that was how tight some of the joints were. I mean, in these massive blocks, I mean, some of them, over 12 feet tall, where they butt up with other stones, I couldn't fit a piece of paper between them in
Did
some
you actually
place.
Try that?
Everyone? Yeah. I mean, I'm just walking around like a dummy trying to stick paper through these stones. Yeah. And the thing is, where the joints come up to one another, they're radiused on the corners, like you would do if you were doing something out of clay that was going to be outside, like you'd kind of radius the edges of them a little bit, for the water or whatever to roll off better. It was just the way they were shaped. I mean, it's just, I don't know how they did it. And, your tour guides there and people, they're real quick to point out. They're like, it's the ancient aliens is real popular, but it wasn't aliens, ha ha ha. The Incan people weren't stupid. Well, nobody's saying they're stupid. What we're saying is, there doesn't really seem to be a whole lot of technology today, hardly, to move those stones from where they say they came from over that type of terrain. And place them and to cut them with such precision. So it's just mind boggling. It really is baffles me. I have no idea.
If I'm not mistaken, an Incan ruler actually tried to recreate one of the buildings, or at least one of the building styles that had been done there, and they tried to lug this massive boulder up a mountainside, and it ended up falling and killing hundreds of his own workers. So, like, a lot of these constructions are in very remote places, And as you said, some of them are hundreds and hundreds of tons. Even something that would be difficult for us to do today. And it's like, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't say one way or another. I'm not one of those guys going, okay, the ancient alien theory is 100% correct. The, you know, humans created it with stone mallets and, you know, copper chisels is 100% correct. But, you know, for me, it's like, okay, well, how the fuck did they do this shit? Like, like what conceivable, like, for me, it's a puzzle. It's how did somebody get the stone up there and do it? It's not.
I'm the same way. I don't know how they did it. And the thing is like, okay, you want to say that they move these things with wooden rollers and all this stuff. Well, the thing is the altitude is so high up in a lot of these places that there aren't even any trees. So how are you going to get wooden rollers unless you're moving, you know, tons and tons of wood from lower altitudes, you know, all the way up there? And then, you know, they didn't even have iron, but guess what? You know, a lot of these stones, the hardness of them is harder than iron. So you know, how did you cut it? You know, you can't cut something that hard with copper or whatever. I mean, copper's too soft. So I don't know. You're right. It's a puzzle.
And it goes to the point where, okay, a lot of these guys are saying, oh, it was done with, like, you know, this you know, shaping stone and, like, maybe a copper chisel. Like, okay, buddy, have you actually tried to shape a stone that looks exactly like this yourself? Or get somebody who is actually a stone worker. Give them the tools and test it out. My biggest thing is the... I kind of feel insulted when somebody tells me this is the way it was done, and then it's like, I don't think this is the way that it's done. Have you done it? No. Then how the hell do you know? Like, seriously. Even with like, especially dealing with ancient Egypt, where a lot of the same rock shaping with pre-dynastic work has been found. I know with there's, and again, I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But essentially it's a vault with these massive sarcophagi that they say used to contain bulls, and they're all made out of like granite and diorite, and they're hundreds and hundreds of tons with, you know, these with these sarcophagi lids that are 2 feet thick, and the entire thing was chiseled out of solid stone. And not only that, We're talking about they had to basically get these things, which are like 12 feet by 9 feet by however, you know, this large, massive, carved, multi-ton block, and maneuver it down into this small little dark hole, and then move it into this alcove where it maybe had a foot on either side the entire way. It's like, why aren't we talking about how they actually got this in here, not just how they chiseled it? Like, come on.
Exactly.
So, no, I know with ancient Egypt, one of the prevailing theories with regards to how the pyramids, like the three major pyramids in Giza, are laid out is to the constellation of Orion. And I know with Teotihuacan in Mexico, one of the theories is that the three pyramids at Teotihuacan are actually laid out to about the same way. What are your kind of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's something that I've heard as well, and a lot of some of the Pueblo sites in the American Southwest are supposedly have some similar orientations. An interesting thing, and I don't know if it's true or not, but there's those that believe on Mars that there's a three pyramids and possibly even a Sphinx on Mars that have a similar orientation. That's something that I've heard. I have no idea if it's true, but it would be cool if it was.
Well, you know, if I ever have Richard Hoagland on this program, I will invite you on to be my guest co-host. Because he's all about that. That's how he built his career, as far as speaking is concerned.
Yeah, he knows his stuff as far as that goes. It's interesting. I don't know how you prove it, but it's very, very cool.
Well, you know, if we ever make it out to Mars, apparently SpaceX is going to bring us there by 2060. I'm saying go right to Cydonia and check it out.
Absolutely.
even authors like Graham Hancock have done books on Mars, which I find absolutely just fantastical in a possible source to where humanity came from or where we visited before. Because Mars has been ha had a very similar climate to Earth at some point, so we don't know. It's kind of goes back to the whole, well, what's out there?
Right. Yeah, we may be Martians. Who knows?
That was actually a theory I proposed to Richard way back in, I think it might have been like 2011. I sent him an email. I'm like, maybe we're actually from there. And he emailed me back, and then he realized that I was kind of as crazy as probably most of the people who send him emails like that. I'm like, oh shit, okay, probably should have sent him that. So I'd love to have him on here to just be able to kind of apologize, but still, it's not as you think like stuff like that. It's more along the lines of science fiction, considering, but you don't know. It's kind of like even when it comes to like stuff like Sasquatch, and I know like you being a cryptozoologist, enthusiast, Sasquatch is kind of like the go-to for a lot of guys when it comes to cryptozoology because it's the one that's the most, I'm gonna say, the most well-known, beyond like let's say, the Chupacabra south of the border. But when it comes to Sasquatch, like what have you run into as far as your work is concerned? Like, has there been any parallels dealing with Sasquatch at all?
Well, sure. Sasquatch is just so prevalent all over, of course, all over Canada and the United States too, and even in the U.S. in places that you would never ever think that that a Sasquatch could live. I mean, you get reports. I mean, there's reports. I want to say every state. I'm not, I'm not an expert on that, but there's reports, all over the place, and even where I live here in Virginia, we have over 1 million acres of just protected national forest on top of the Shenandoah National Park and the protected state lands and things. And from time to time you hear Sasquatch reports from there. And it's interesting. Who knows if something's out there or not, but it seems possible anyway.
Now, have you ever potentially had a Sasquatch sighting?
No, I've not. Never had anything like that. I've never had any interesting, kind of sightings like that. Unfortunately, I wish I would, but then again, it'd probably scare the hell out of me if I did see one. So maybe it's for the best.
Now, what do you think of some of the reports as far as Sasquatch is concerned with regards to its like psychic powers? I know some people say that like Les Stroud, if you've ever heard of Survivor Man, he's a Canadian guy who basically taught survivor skills, kind of like Bear Grylls, but not full of shit. So like he did an entire season of Survivor Man based on just based on trying to find Sasquatch. And even he said that he found like he had kind of like these thoughts in his head where it's like, okay, well, if you want to, like the Sasquatch are kind of talking to him as it were. What are your thoughts on that being a possibility? And like, have you ever run into anything close to that, or heard anybody from anybody, or heard anything from anybody with regards to that?
Well, you do hear things like that, and personally. I don't know if I buy it or not. I mean, if there is a Sasquatch, I which, you know, I think that there probably is, but I'm not, you know, I could go either way on it, but there's definitely something going on, but I prefer to think of it as, you know, some sort of more ape than man, I guess, and maybe some sort of missing link or something. But you do hear that stuff like that about, you know, psychic abilities. And another interesting thing is a lot of time when there's Sasquatch, you know, a rash of sightings in a particular area, there's sometimes an uptick in other types of paranormal activity, like UFO sightings, that sort of thing. So, you know, I'm not sure how it's related or whatever, but an interesting thing. I mean, if there is some kind of, you know, psychic or spiritual connection, it would, you know, certainly explain why nobody's ever been able to get any concrete evidence on it.
Going on like more of the UFO sightings, I know of very many people who've had Sasquatch sightings. I know, like, especially here around Ontario, a lot of woodland between here and Toronto. And Ottawa is a very wooded area. Like, outside of our city limits, it's pretty much just sticks all the way till the next town. Like, 100%.
Yeah.
I have a, like, there's this one lake that my family goes to once a year called Christie Lake. It's a very large, lake, lots of bass. There's some catfish there, you know, good fishing all year round. And one of the friends of my wife's family actually apparently caught a Sasquatch on camera in one of their trail cams last year. I haven't actually seen the picture. If I had it, I would put it up right now. But, you know, it's like, even out here, they still have them. It just kind of blows my mind. Like, I thought they were, their reports from out west in BC all the way out to here to this, you know, the southern United States. Yet, they stay completely away from populated areas. And for anybody that I've talked to who's had a Sasquatch sighting, and I've probably talked to maybe about two or three, but even those that I know of who, other people who've talked to them, you don't get many people who have had UFO sightings while also having Sasquatch sightings, which I kind of found strange. Even when it comes to most paranormal stuff, it's like you don't get people who have an overlap, as it were, a lot of the time. Like, if you haven't had any cryptozoology, like, you know, I know you've got an interest in UFOs. Have you seen a UFO? Even an unexplained blip of light in the sky?
No. I haven't seen anything cool, unfortunately.
you got to hang around me a little bit. Like, come up to Ottawa, I will show you some cool shit, because I've seen more than my share, and it scares the shit out of me, I swear.
Oh, really?
Oh, man. Oh, like, a couple, like, what was it? I think it was two, 3 months back. I actually had one buzz my house.
Wow.
I had two glowing orbs, which I had basically been tracking. Actually, I put it, if you check my Twitter, on my actual Twitter handle, not the Den of Lore Twitter, I actually have a video of it, a very, very shaking video of it, that I basically, like, live broadcast for the better part of about, like, a minute or two. Like, this was after being scared out of my bloody mind and going, like, wait a second, if I'm going to get abducted, I might as well get this shit on, you know, like, actually make some money off of it or something.
Wow.
And then I go back and look at it, I'm like, oh, no, I've turned into every single stereotype of UFO footage.
Oh, man.
Oh, but, like, in your travels, has anybody, like, really brought forth a good Sasquatch story that came along with a UFO sighting at the same time, or even just a Sasquatch sighting? Like, you know, you're out there more or less in you know, pretty, like, dense bush, so there has to have been something you've seen, or somebody.
Well, people contact me through my website or social media all the time. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a lady sent me a pretty good report from Oklahoma about her husband had an encounter, and he actually almost went in. I guess he has some heart problems or whatever, and he almost she was thinking he was having a heart attack when he got back. You know, he was so worked up about it, and you know, she was supposed to send along some pictures of some tracks, you know, out there, but I never, you know, haven't heard any more back on that. But as far as the story goes, it sounded like they definitely, you know, saw something out there. And you know, from the descriptions, it you know, wasn't a bear. Yeah, it wasn't wasn't anything that you could really explain from the misidentification of a known animal. You know,
we're just hoping that it wasn't some hippie raver who had not like bathed in a month.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of one of those things. Like I'm of the mind that I'm like, okay, well, do I really want to know? If a Sasquatch like tapped into my mind psychically and said, "Hey, do you want to meet us?" It's like, maybe.
You might want to leave it alone.
Yeah. Like I'm kind of like, I want to know the truth, but at the same time, it's like, if I know the truth about my own experience, I'd be shit scared. Just to be able to kind of find out what the hell is going on. Like, ancient history is one thing. You know, when you're dealing with the unknown, it's like, I don't know how I'd react, whether I'd be like, oh, this is awesome, or whether I'd be going screaming like a girl out into the forest, you know, in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah, you might not be able to handle the information.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, the you know, knowledge, they say, like, the truth will set you free. I'm like, well, if set you free is freedom out in the woods with my hands, you know, waving above my head while I'm going, yeah, maybe. Well, what about some of the research that you're doing, like, right now? Like, you said at the top of the show that you have been conducting some new research. Like, is there a third book that's maybe on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm working on a book right now, and it's about it's kind of a broad book about all sorts of cryptids, Sasquatch, some flying creatures, all sorts of things over in West Virginia. I've been doing a lot of research there, and West Virginia is really a hotbed for weird things, paranormal activity. I mean, most people have heard of Mothman and things like that, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's just a lot of weird and cool things over there. So I'm putting putting some research in, and I've got a good bit of writing done on a third book. So hopefully, God willing, it'll be out sometime next year, I hope.
Now, you know, when this comes out, I'm going to be listening to John Denver the entire time.
Yeah.
Well, it's my, like, my wife and I, is one of our, like, it's our road trip song. So it's like, okay, that's good.
There's really a lot of cool stuff. A lot of cool stuff out there. You know, we're talking about the burial mounds. There's just tons of those out there. There's a lot of good haunted places. It was during the Civil War. There were, and here where I live in Virginia, you know, there's a lot of residual, I guess, hauntings or whatever from a lot of the old Civil War sites and things like that. So you have a lot of that out in West Virginia, and West Virginia's, you know, very wooded, pretty desolate, low population in a lot of places, and, you know, just a real prime country for weird creatures to hide or hang out or whatever.
Now, is there a hopeful date for this release that you're hoping to have out?
I'm just kind of saying, you know, I'm hoping it'll be out before next summer, like late spring is kind of what I'm shooting for. But, you know, with working full time and being a full time dad and husband and all that, you know, sometimes you get sidetracked. But it'll be out hopefully by the middle of next year sometime. I'm hoping.
Well, you're preaching to the choir on that one, I can tell you that. well, Denver, definitely we're gonna check up on with you when that actually does come out, and I'm gonna devour that book just like I did the last one. And we'll have you back on when and we'll rekindle our conversation about Zuul, because again, this is probably one of the most fun episodes that I've had so far. And I'd like to thank you very much, as well as the listeners that were listening in. Again, this show will be on, especially with last week's episode. Today is Wednesday, correct? The 19th. So we'll have both last week's episode plus this one up by noon tomorrow. And again, if you have any questions, if you want to be on the show, if you want to ask have your stuff read out, email me, Chris, at info@denoflore.com. Follow us on Twitter at denoflore. Pretty simple. Check us out, denoflore.com. In addition to that, also, please do subscribe to the channel so that we can continue to bring cool shows like this to you, the listeners. Until then, my name is Chris George Zuger, and this is the Den of Lore, signing off. Thank you all, and have a wonderful evening.